This talk by Noah Levine was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles, California, and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
The Buddha said that his enlightenment experience and his teachings, this meditative path, went against the stream. He talked about the stream, the norm in human life, is the stream of avoidance. That it's totally normal. It's the norm. It's the status quo. That when you're in pain, to try to get rid of it. To try to run from it. To try to replace it with pleasure constantly, rather than acknowledge the pain that we're in. That that's the norm. And one of the reasons he said that the path was against the stream is because he found that the end of suffering came from doing the opposite, no longer running, no longer floating along with what's the next fix, but turning towards and going in the opposite direction of inviting it in. And that famous night of the Buddha's enlightenment, as he sat under the Bodhi tree and was attacked by all of the demons of his mind, all of the ways that he suffered, that we all suffer. All of the lust, all of the fear, all of the anger, violence, doubt, judgment, restlessness, all of it came to him. And his solution was, he invited it all in. He sat there, and he sat there, and he said, "Bring it on." Bring it on. And if we can do that in our meditation practice, we can come to a place where we're unperturbed. And it's just anger again. Big surprise. Rather than, "I'm now angry, I'm pissed off." Now, I think this is very important. Because what the Buddha did and what's proposed here is not that we're going to get rid of our difficulties. We're not going to get rid of our doubting mind. We're not going to get rid of worry arising, or fear, or anger, or those self-judgmental thoughts. We're not going to get rid of them. Now, maybe they'll lessen. Actually, I'm sure that they will decrease. The difficulties do decrease, but even for the enlightened Buddha, they don't go away forever. But the willingness to meet it with compassion, the skill to meet it with non-identification, non-attachment, increases. And so then whatever comes, we have the capacity to meet in the appropriate way. The only appropriate relationship to pain is compassion. If it's painful and you're doing anything except for meeting it with mercy and compassion and forgiveness, you're having a dysfunctional relationship to it. If it's painful and you're doing anything but caring about it, you're creating suffering on top of your pain. This is Buddhism 101. Core, simple truth. So our goal is to meet all pain with compassion. It's the only wise response. It's the only thing that works. But it isn't some kind of decision that we can just make. "Oh, okay, that sounds good. I heard that in a Dharma talk. I'll just meet all of my pain with compassion from now on." Wouldn't that be nice if we could just take a class and then that's it? We could do it. It's a life's work. It's because we're so wired to meet our pain with hatred, with aversion. Meditation is rewiring, is retraining our heart minds, hearts and minds. It's a very different way of looking at things, of looking at each difficulty as an opportunity for compassion rather than as a curse. There's actually a very common Buddhist practice where some Buddhists will pray for difficulties on a daily basis. More of a northern school, more of a Tibetan practice, but there's actually a Tibetan prayer that says, "May I be met with the appropriate difficulties today so that I have the opportunity to respond with compassion." Because they so deeply understand the necessity of compassion. And they understand that you need some difficulties in your life in order to be compassionate. To have the opportunity to be forgiving, to be loving, to be generous, to be kind. Imagine that. Does anybody want to take on that prayer? You want to start praying for difficulties? We don't have to, right? We really don't have to. But I think it's important also, the appropriate difficulty. Manageable difficulties. Not overwhelming catastrophe that's just... And so each of us, what's appropriate changes. As your compassion, as your wisdom, as you awaken more and more, what you can handle changes. What you can appropriately respond to increases. Yeah, we don't have to pray for it. That's just the way life is. Life is difficult. There's plenty of opportunities each day, each moment. Inviting the demons in for tea. That willingness to sit there like the Buddha did and say, okay, anxiety, what are you going to do? Kill me? Willing to be the first person to die of agitation. Of fear, of doubt, of worry, and really turning towards it. And when we turn towards it, often you see how insubstantial it is. When we run from it, it really feels like it can be this force, this demon in our lives. But when you turn towards it, I don't know if anybody had that experience tonight in meditation. You will, as you turn towards it, you'll start to see, oh, it's just tension in my body and increased heart rate. And, you know, it feels like this, and there's these sets of thoughts with it. But it's just sensations and thoughts and emotions, and there's nothing actually substantial to this fear. It's actually the fear of the fear that's worse than the fear. The fear itself is just, okay, flux and doubt and... tightness in my belly. Several people said, and this isn't in any way a criticism, but several people said, talked about the honesty of the insecurity of our lives, of the human condition. That we suffer about trying to find, kind of make a foundation. To find security. Someone said, through the eyes of wisdom, the only sense of security in the human life is a false sense of security. That there actually is no security. The more you understand impermanence, the more you really see that what Buddha called anicca, constant change, the flux, the flow, the impermanent nature of all things, the more you understand that, the more you see, like, how can you find permanence, stability, right? We want permanence in an impermanent universe where everything's changing, everything's unfolding, everyone's dying. There's no security. And if, as long as there is a delusion, from this Buddhist perspective, a delusion of a separate, solid self, as long as we think that we truly exist permanently, there's going to be this insecurity. Now, that's not to say, that's sort of an ultimate truth. On a relative level, on a relative truth, I feel pretty secure about my wife and daughter. I feel pretty secure in our relationship. I'm not saying that there's something bad about feeling secure temporarily, right? Part of my security, part of my ability to feel that way is knowing that it's constantly changing and knowing that the relationship and whatever it is much more like, I don't know what a good analogy is, much more like surfing a wave where it's constant rebalancing and kind of the bottom turn and then coming back up. And it's much more that sort of engaged, constant change balance than it is just, I found a solid place to stand type of security. There is no solid place to stand. There is only the ability in this life to rebalance constantly, to acknowledge, oh, you're changing, I'm changing, everything's changing. The breath teaches us that. The meditation teaches us that. It's one of the first and most important insights that we have in Buddhist meditation. The more we see impermanence, the more we acknowledge it, the less we suffer. The more we truly come into harmony with impermanence, with insecurity. Alan Watts wrote a book called The Wisdom of Insecurity. That actually, if you are feeling too secure, you're deluded. You're delusional. If you're feeling insecure and kind of insubstantial and like everything is constantly being pulled out from under your feet, you're wise. You're seeing it clearly. That's the way that it actually is. That's a wisdom heart perspective. If you feel like, my father liked to say, if you think you have your shit together, you're definitely standing in it. Right? And it's why, as we started tonight, it's so important to come together with groups of people and say, I don't have my shit together. I'm trying to surf these waves and to live in this world where everything's changing and there's nothing really to hold on to. Trying. Meditation helps. Trying to deal with this mind that is so disobedient. Isn't it strange that we take our minds so personally and we believe what our minds tell us? But you sit down to meditate and you tell your mind, stop thinking, and your mind says, fuck you, I got plans to make. Why do we think we're these minds that so clearly are out of our control? So clearly, if we could control these minds, life would be easy, it would be pleasant. You would just say, okay, mind, don't take anything personal anymore. No more suffering. Stop worrying, right? Stop feeling anxious. Stop doubting. Stop being afraid. But we don't have that kind of control over our minds. And it's because the mind isn't who we are. Meditation allows us to change our relationship to the mind. Allows us to awaken to the truth that we're not the mind. That there's a spiritual process unfolding here that's not just mental or psychological. But it's a strange balance because it's training the mind with the mind. Even the word mindfulness. You know, it's when we start getting into the difference between wholesome and unwholesome thoughts, wise versus deluded or confused. And this internal battle, all of those demons, they're all in the mind. Your difficulties exist anywhere but in your mind? Are they real? Would you still have those difficulties if you had a lobotomy? If you didn't have a mind? Maybe. I mean, if there some of our difficulties are tangible, but almost I don't know, it feels like almost all of them exist in the mind. On our mind's relationship to our body and to each other. So I know this isn't a very comforting philosophy. But I think, again, it's one of the reasons why Buddha called it against the stream. Because he said, well, okay, I'm going to go teach people that there's no secure place. There's nothing to stand on. I'm going to go teach people that I can only, that the best we can do is to end suffering, but we can't get rid of pain. I'm going to go teach people that our only hope is compassion towards pain, but that we can't actually eradicate difficult emotions. We can only eradicate dysfunctional relationship to difficult emotions. His first thought was, people aren't gonna like this. People want happily ever after. Buddhism only offers the end of suffering. Which, compared to suffering, sounds like a pretty good deal. But it's not the fantasy that most of us show up with. It's not the fantasy of, if I meditate enough, I won't be me anymore. It's what you're really looking for, right? Freedom from self. Freedom from being, having your mind. It's not the way it works. Freedom from taking your mind personal, possibly. So anyways, these are some of my thoughts, and really deeply, and it's coming out of a personal place that I'm in with my practice, and feeling like, you know, life's been a bit difficult. And I have, you know, I would say I have a blessed life. My mind's been a bit difficult. And I've been really trying to turn towards the difficulties in my mind. I've also been making some changes in my life to try to address some of the stressors and some of the difficulties. I'm not at all saying, you know, don't take action. Take action. But for me, it's been so important to use these difficulties as practice, not as the enemy, not as the... Long time ago, somebody taught me, and I don't know who it was. It might have been one of my therapists or a sponsor or somebody. Meditation teacher. I forget who it was. But I was getting stuck in that unprofitable cycle of asking why. Why is it like this? Why am I suffering so much? Why am I so insecure? Do I have so much worry, so much doubt, so much fear, so much lust, so much greed, so much hatred? Why, you know? And not that that's a total dead end, but often it's a dead end. And they taught me to reframe the question. They say, why probably is the inappropriate question 90% of the time for a spiritual practitioner. But if you can replace the why with how, like I'm talking about tonight, how can I use this difficulty as an opportunity for compassion? How can I use this as an opportunity to be mindful, to forgive, to be loving, to be wise? Not why is this happening to me, I feel like such a victim. How can I respond in the wisest way? How can I relate to this mind in a different way? Okay, through mindfulness, through loving kindness, through compassion. Or, so either how or what? What's the appropriate response? Not why is this happening? What is the appropriate... It is happening. It is happening. It's like this. Mary just got a tattoo of quoting one of our teachers, a really famous kind of... It's been saying a lot. Right now, it's like this. Why... isn't going to get you anymore. But what is the appropriate response to it is going to get you free. Why is probably going to cause more suffering? Often. How can I respond to it? What's the appropriate response? It's going to be a profitable inquiry. So these are some of my thoughts about practicing, some of my current experience. What's the appropriate response? So any questions, any comments, any clarifications about any of these perspectives? Yeah.
I know for me, I'm not trying to suppress feelings, but I also really want to focus on my breath. I've even tried focusing on my heartbeat too. Something that's not just dangerous. I think almost like tonight too, it's like, I know from personal experience I've found that things that I consider my problems, or even like welcoming the demons, as you say, in practice right now outside of the world, it seems that so much of like my quote unquote demons are just because I'm thinking about them so much. And that almost, that's kind of what clarification I'm asking, I guess. My question is like, I've known that things that in my life that I thought like was a problem and then I got solved, I always found another problem. And so, I think it's almost misleading in some regards to welcome the demons, because welcoming them is, we're creating our problems by obsessing about our own mind, rather than just focusing on whatever we're supposed to be doing. So, like, for me, I just acknowledge, okay, whatever is I'm feeling, and then I just go back. But, like, too much self-psychoanalysis is really what is the issue, in my opinion.
It can be, for sure. I agree with you completely. And the best of this sort of practice is that you come out with that sort of wisdom. Is that you see, as you invite them in, how insubstantial they are. And it sounds like you've sort of come to that through your practice and through understanding that I'm making this up in some way. Or I'm making it bigger than it actually is. And when I invite it in, when I turn towards it, I see how insubstantial it often is. Or impersonal it is. Or how the fear of it is worse, or the judgment of it is worse than the actual experience. The actual experience is very manageable.
And might there be like a point, like, I know I'm not there, but I mean, if your practice is, where you invite the demons in and like no one comes, and then you keep searching for more. I feel like that's kind of like the thing. Like, you can always find something else. It's like, okay, now I don't feel sad. I'm probably angry though.
I don't know, because I'm not at that kind of end of practice where there's no difficulties. But I think of the Buddha's life's experience and that kind of what I'm calling the demons, sort of traditionally what's called Mara, and the difficult emotions and experiences of being human that the Buddha battled under the Bodhi tree. And his experience was that he had victory and transformed his relationship to Mara, to these demons. But that Mara didn't go away forever, that all through his life, and even to the very end of his enlightened career, 45 years of living as an enlightened being, Mara continued to return. So it wasn't that, your kind of comment, that it was gone, but continued to return. And that each time, and he didn't have to go looking for it, but in different circumstances, he say, and then Mara came back and kind of checked in the form of greed, in the form of hatred or lust or anger or whatever it was. And that each time Mara came back, the Buddha's relationship was, I see you, Mara. Right? I see the demon as it arises, the difficult emotion, the old, doubt that I used to take so personal. Now I notice it. Oh, it's just doubt. I see it, and I don't suffer about it. So I don't know if your question was if we ever get to a place where they're gone and then we're creating them. I think that actually this is just part of having a mind. It's part of having a human mind and heart and body. It's part of our psychology and our biology that we're going to have these difficult emotions. That we're going to have some aversion to pain. That's going to arise on some level as a resentment or hatred. It's going to come. We're going to have some craving for pleasure. It's going to come in the form of lust, greed, something like that. That's just part of being human. And that our practice is always going to be to say, okay, let me see this clearly as it is. Not run from it, not be unconsciously driven by it, but in relationship to it. That makes sense?
Yeah. I guess just the pinpoints that really when I acknowledge anger, mm-hmm. is it really all you're at? Because I know every meditation style has its own pieces. So if I acknowledge anger, I mean I shouldn't sit there now again like asking why or how. Even how, it's just like just acknowledge it and move back to the breath. Is that really what we're supposed to do? We're supposed to be sitting and
So anger is painful. Right? The Buddha said anger is often like grabbing the burning coal out of the fire. It hurts to hold on. Right? Anger is a form of holding on to some pain. What's the appropriate response? The appropriate response is compassion. So I'm not encouraging you to yank your attention away from the anger and back to the breath. I'm encouraging you to meet that anger with compassion. Or more likely, meet the pain that's fueling the anger with compassion. So you can hang out with the anger. You can invite it in. You can say, welcome, anger. Okay, pain. I see the pain that's underneath this anger. I see my bruised heart, my bruised ego, my fear, whatever it is that's pissing me off now. And I meet you with as much compassion as I can muster. Now, when that dissolves and you're not angry anymore and the compassion, then you can come back to the breath. But don't use the breath as a way to distract yourself from emotion. In that case. You know what I mean? Yeah, try to hang out with it. Try to have the appropriate response to it. Yeah.
It seems to me that there's another... you know, we talk about how there's either you're a Buddha or you're suffering like everybody else. But it seems to me there's like a third thing. And it kind of comes back to the beginning of the night for me when I understand that we're suffering from it. And just in the past few days, for a little bit I haven't been. And I think there's a long time, there's a time where you could just be really dysfunctional and you're not functioning. And then if you do this work for a while, you're not Buddha. But you get your life going sort of in a way when you actually like feel good or confident. And so when you were talking about that if you think you have your shit together, you're probably standing in it. I was sort of playing with that in my mind because like when the past few days, you know, as I felt things, I thought about something, I felt pain. I'd go into meditation and I could see that I would not identify with the thought. And then I could feel that pain, and if you hold your attention on it gently, it starts to dissolve, right? Mm-hmm. And then for the first time in a long time, I started to feel very good. And then after a few days, my fear started to really recede a lot. And now I feel much more kind of secure. So it seems to me like there's not to say that there's just sort of suffering or losing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I get what you're saying. It's not as black and white as that, and there's not quite the duality maybe that the language or my language is creating around it. You know, part of what the word Buddha means, and I know sometimes I'm saying the Buddha, and I'm referring to Siddhartha Gautama 2,500 years ago, but Buddha just means being awake. Right, and so we could sort of make a duality here that you're either awake or you're not, but that you don't have to be awake all of the time, like you're saying. You've had some experiences lately of being awake and not suffering so much, right? And that's wonderful. That doesn't mean that you're a fully enlightened Buddha now,
right.
But that you've been sort of in this process of waking up, as all of us are on one level or another, and that you do have those experiences. Buddha Dasa Bhikkhu, this famous monk in Thailand, called it mini nirvana. He said, there's the parinirvana, that's when you're fully enlightened. But all of us along the path that practice mindfulness and this kind of respond appropriately, you'll have many mini nirvanas throughout your life. You'll have many moments of non-suffering. many moments of being awake. Well, you're not quite a fully enlightened Buddha, but in that moment, you're awake to the way it is. You know that it's impermanent, that it's impersonal, and that if you cling to it, you will suffer. Right? And you're not doing any of that, and you're free. How long that lasts, right? Till somebody steps on your toe, or not, you know? Now, that's, you know, the Buddha kind of lived in that state for years and years. And maybe our hope is to kind of string more of those moments together, to practice in that direction. You're right, there is freedom. It's not either you're completely asleep or you're completely awake. On the path to awakening, there's going to be moments of wakefulness and moments of going back into ignorance. So I agree with you. So last comment, and we'll have to end there.
Well, I just wanted to thank you for having all of us say something that was challenging us. I think, you know, I probably have anxiety about saying my name, much less saying something that's difficult.
Yeah.
But what I was struck by halfway around the room was how, even though I certainly have, you know, a big crunchy issue in the last couple of years of my life, how many of the comments could have really been the top of my list, that everybody's experiences are, you know, they're unique. Everyone has their own life, but they're incredibly common and incredibly shared.
Yeah.
And that everybody that showed up, it seemed like after about the 10th person, most people were kind of ready to say the thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a challenging thing. It's a non-ordinary to speak out. And, but it's also normalizing, part of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. It's so nice to be in a place where, oh, you're suffering too, you're normal. Right? Finally, I found a place where it's okay to be unhappy and to have difficulties. And it's also okay, as Toda is saying, to totally be happy. But that we don't have to fake any of it. With the Four Noble Truths, the first truth that there's suffering in life is a normalizing state. Rather than this kind of unrealistic idea that somehow we get in a lot of places, but it seems like especially in the West, where it's like you're supposed to be happy. And if you're not happy, you've done something wrong. You see parents doing it to their children all of the time. Stop crying. You know, you're making me uncomfortable is what they're saying. I don't have room for that kind of pain. But of course the Dharma is about making room for that pain also. Thank you all.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.